Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
Nearly 10 years after the Pulse nightclub shooting, the building where 49 people were killed is now demolished. In its place, the city of Orlando will build a permanent memorial. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It's Thursday, March 19th, 2026, and parts of our show today may be difficult to listen to as people recount the mass shooting at Pulse. Crews demolished the Pulse nightclub building this week.
You know, I think each individual is in a different place in their healing and recovery. So I don't think there's one emotion that encapsulates it for everybody. I think probably everybody in this crowd here today feels a little bit different in where they are in their evolution of their healing.
That was Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer speaking at the Pulse site Wednesday. He says the building had to come down to honor the family's desire for a permanent memorial at the site of the tragedy.
I view this as more than a demolition. I view it as a major step towards the completion of a permanent memorial that all of the families of the Pulse victims and survivors deeply deserve.
An adjacent building and other structures within a fenced area are also being removed. The process of clearing the site is expected to take several weeks. Artifacts from inside, like posters and parts of the bar and walls, have already been taken out and are being preserved. Some will be part of the permanent memorial scheduled to break ground in September. Even though the building is gone, the loss remains. It's been nearly 10 years since the 49 people were murdered and dozens more injured by a gunman at Pulse during a Latin-themed dance night on June 12, 2016. One of the victims was Luis Omar Ocasio-Cabo. He was 20 years old when he died. His sister, Belinette Ocasio-Cabo, discusses the significance of this week and shares memories about her brother that make her smile when she thinks about him now.
The fact that he used to always say that his gorgeous face was going to take him to Hollywood and become famous. He said his face was going to take him far places in life. He wanted to become an actor. He wanted to do acting. It's crazy because the year that he actually passed, he was supposed to be in the big Lion King theater thing that was supposed to come out. And unfortunately, well, he wasn't able to, but he said his good looks were going to take him very far.
So a lot of attention this week is being put on the Pulse nightclub because demolition is starting. That club has sat just frozen in time for a decade. What does it mean to you to see the demolition happening there and the site changing?
I mean, I'm actually glad that they're finally doing something about it, but it's like a bittersweet moment. I mean, when I go to Florida, it's already like a routine. Like, I land and I go straight to the cemetery and I go straight to Pulse where he was, you know, last there. My kids, you know, they were born after the tragedy. That's what they know, you know, and now going there to not actually see the place, I think it's going to feel weird, but maybe peaceful. I can agree with the whole, when the families were able to go inside, I was one of them that didn't want to go in. I think that would have been way too traumatic or tragic for me to experience. But I'm very glad that they're doing something in their honor. Like, I hope whatever they are doing talks about who they were as a person, not just as a victim of Pulse nightclub.
How do you talk to your kids about your brother?
Well, it's very sad. My oldest son, his name is Jamar, so I name him after Omar. And they're at that age, my oldest is 8 years old, so they're in that age where they're actually questioning what happened to their uncle and why he's in the sky. My little one doesn't know as much, but my oldest one does know that he died in a, in a very tragic incident. He doesn't know all the details, but I always tell him, Omar was a very kind, loving person. He was energetic. He was full of life. We call him our star because he was always our star. And, I always tell him, whenever you feel sad, whenever you want to talk to somebody, you can always talk to your Omar because no matter what, he always listens to you guys. Somehow I like to believe that, And they talk. We have done projects in school where my son was he represented Barack Obama, and when Obama went and impacted us, because we have letters from Obama. When all this happened, and my son got to present, he got to talk about his uncle, he got to talk about Obama and all the things they did. So I think, they my oldest isn't sad because he does think about it and he does get emotional sometimes.
It's been almost a decade. How has this long of a stretch of time been like for you, just waiting to see what was going to happen at that site?
I feel like I had to be like the strong one in the family for my mom. So I just feel like this is very sad for her, at this moment. Like she even had to move over Orlando because of the situation. It was just too overwhelming seeing the site and all this stuff, I can't say that we are okay, but because of our love, or my mom always taught us to love each other no matter what and to always support each other. And if it wasn't from the love and connection me, my siblings, and my mom have with each other, I don't think we will be the way we are today. Like I could talk strongly now without crying or tearing about what happened to my brother. I could probably said I am his sister, and I will make sure that his face is still well known around the world.
And as Orlando prepares to build a permanent memorial, what do you want people who visit there years from now to understand about your brother?
That he fought for his life. He really wanted to live. My brother was an amazing person in and out. Not only was he had a beautiful face, like he said, but he had a beautiful heart. He was full of love and the careless of the club and him being trapped because he was one of the victims that was trapped in a room with a Coca-Cola in the exit, which he was trapped in a room and he bled out basically. That's something that it's tough on us to know that he died because we just found this out about a year ago. So it's tough, it's tough sometimes to just think about what happened in there, the fact that it's been so many years and we still don't have all the answers that we want to.
Do you keep in touch with other families?
Yes, but I actually keep in contact with the girl that was with my brother that night. My kids call her auntie, so she's part of our family. And we do have in contact. My mom has mostly contact with the moms, but we do hang out sometimes. I mean, they made it to my baby shower out here in Ohio.
When you think about 10 years from now, how do you keep your brother's memory from fading to time?
I always try to do my possible, like with my kids. I have kids now, so I make sure that my brother's memory is alive through them. We do projects together where we talk about him. I live in Cleveland, Ohio, so I do have a lot of people known him here. They had an expedition of an opening of an art gallery with all the victims' faces, including my brother's. And every summer around this time, I don't usually visit Florida, but I do always do something here in Ohio in his honor, where all his friends and my family and other members that can't go to Florida, we all get together every year faithfully on the 12th to remember who he was, not only him, but also the victims.
Bellinette Ocasio-Capo lost her brother in the Pulse shooting. This is a week of mixed emotions for families. I texted with a survivor who told me talking about the demolition and renovation is completely and utterly exhausting, and that every time the city moves a brick or holds a press conference, it feels like survivors' voices might be overlooked. We also spoke to Joshua Hernandez Carrion. He survived after being shot twice.
It's going to be 10 years, and we still don't have no memorial. We don't have nothing, you know? And it's the time to get the memorial done.
Since that night, Pulse had remained closed. The One Pulse Foundation was created to build a permanent memorial. A temporary one was put in place at the nightclub that was supposed to be there for 2 years. However, the foundation faced controversy, accused of misspending donations and taxpayer funds. It was dissolved in 2023. The city of Orlando later purchased the Pulse property with the promise of building a permanent memorial. At a press conference this week, I brought the concerns being raised by some survivors that their voices will be lost amid all the attention on the demolition to Mayor Dyer. I asked how the city makes sure families feel included in what comes next. He said from the very start, the process has been driven by a committee of survivors, family members, or others closely connected to Pulse. The impact of this week and healing are different for everyone, including those who arrived in the immediate aftermath to help. Deborah Beidle is a psychology professor and executive director of UCF Restores that provides treatment to first responders and survivors of mass violence. The UCF Restores team responded to Pulse after the shooting, and Beidle still works with those who need support today. How does seeing the physical sight of something that significant, seeing it disappear, how does that impact people, starting with maybe first responders?
Well, I think in general, it's going to be different for everyone who was there that night or who knew someone who was there that night. I think for the first responders, for some of them, it's going to represent some closure because that place that they went into that night and did the brave work that they did, there's no longer a reminder of that. But, you know, the reminders are sometimes carried inside of people, too. So I don't know that there's one answer for that. But I think the important thing is that everyone understands that the journey away from trauma and away from grief and toward recovery is individual.
What does the building itself represent? What does that signify?
I think the building itself represents the place where something horrible happened, where people's lives were lost, that there was bravery that night in terms of saving other people. But for many people, it's a memorial. It's no different from when you see people with crosses on the side of the road marking the place where they lost a loved one. It can also represent a place for people to come together and grieve collectively about the losses that occurred that night. So I think there is a lot of that, people wanting the memorial to stay, wanting the building to be there to continue that. But on the other hand, for other people, they're just happy that it's gone because it's too painful a reminder of what happened that night, and not seeing it may be helpful for some people in their journey to recovery.
So is it possible for this demolition to be both a place of pain and healing?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is possible to be both. And I think particularly with the understanding that there is another memorial coming, that getting rid of this building does not mean that we are forgetting the souls of those who were lost that night or those who still carry the injuries and the pain from what happened that night. It's not that the building is making it go away. It's that something else is coming in its place so that there will continue to be a reminder in the city and a place of hopefully healing and hope as a result of the new memorial that will be constructed.
And this demolition is happening to make way for that new memorial. Can you help me understand why it's so significant to have a permanent memorial? What do memorials provide?
Memorials provide several things. They first provide some education for people who might not really know what happened that night. So they're a marker in time, a marker for history, so to speak, that something significant happened that day in June, and that it was important enough that we need to remember it. It's an indication to the families who lost someone that evening or to the survivors that they're not forgotten, that they are remembered in an effective way, and that they will never be forgotten. And I think for the community in general, it's a reminder of what all of us went through that day and in the weeks afterward, the way the community came together. And having a memorial there allows us to continue to have that sense of belonging and that sense of connection to others.
We're coming up on a decade since the Pulse shooting. You study trauma. Why do some milestones like the 10-year remembrance hit harder than others?
Because I think that 10 years represents what we call a decade. So we sometimes think in larger chunks than a day, a month, or a year. And I think there are significant milestones, particularly in terms of 5, 10, 20 years out, that seem to represent something, a significant point from there. I think, though, in general, for the people who are suffering, those significant milestones may be less noticeable because they're having the struggle every day. And even all those years later may continue to struggle in that time. I think sometimes people think that, well, it's been 10 years, I should be over this. And I want to discourage people from thinking about those shoulds. Because again, this was a very significant event. People will recover in their own way. And there's no such thing as saying, well, it's been 10 years, you should be better by now. That just doesn't exist. Although sometimes outsiders put some kind of closure on something like that.
Is closure something that can even be achieved?
I think it really depends on how you define closure. Some people will say, when I think about the person that I lost that night, I used to cry. Now I can remember that person and there's a smile that crosses my face. I still miss them, but I can now think of the good times that we had or how that person impacted my life rather than thinking about just the horrible situation of that night. I don't think that you ever get to a place where it's like, well, you know, I was there the night of the shooting, you know, something that happened to me, but I don't think about it anymore. I don't think that necessarily is possible. I think it's a matter of not letting that event totally take control of your life anymore. So that you get to a point where you said, this is something that happened to me. This changed me, because I think these kind of traumatic events change people forever. But I can grow from it. You know, I can look back and rather than thinking about my friend who was shot that night, I can remember the time that we went to the beach or visited New York City or something like that, so that they can put it in perspective and it no longer controls every single aspect of their life. I also think that the people who were injured that night, you know, they carry their scars with them. So the building may come down, but if you were injured that night, you're going to have a daily reminder of what happened to you. And that's something that people can also in some ways put in perspective, but maybe more difficult because the impact on them was so much more personal.
You know, that keeping the memory alive, that notion, that is a fear a lot of people have talked to have. That the victims will be forgotten to time.
And I think that we see this after every mass shooting that has happened. It's in the news for several weeks. There are pictures of those who were victim to this event. And I think then afterwards, the general public forgets. But the people who are most affected, they never forget. And it is concerning to them that no one else really cares anymore or thinks about them. And that's why I think having the memorial is so important, because it's a community's commitment to the fact that there will be a permanent remembrance of the lives that were lost that night and the people who were injured and the first responders who risked their lives to go in and help. So I think having that there, I think if they had just torn down the nightclub with no plans for that, that would be harder than knowing that there's going to be something that will be there in its place and will be a memorial.
How do you counsel someone who is involved in what they're experiencing right now? I don't know if it's a form of PTSD, but how do you counsel someone from something so far removed?
In the same way that we would counsel anyone at any stage along the way, I think, first of all, by what I said before, reminding them that there's no timeline that they should be following, that what they're feeling is what they're feeling, and that we can work together to help make some meaning out of what happened to them. I think a day like today is going to be really difficult for people. When the 10th anniversary comes along, that's going to be difficult for people. I think acknowledging that and giving people the notion that it's okay to feel the way that they're feeling, that this was a horrific event and our mind just doesn't erase those events. But how can we in some way grow from this experience? There's something called post-traumatic growth. And that is a way that many people have taken something horrific that has happened and have tried to make meaning out of it and make something good come out of that kind of horrible experience. And for many people, even this many years later, doing something like that, finding a way to memorialize a person or an event, really allows people to have some sense of control over what happened. And I think the other thing we talk to people about is that their anxiety, their depression, their grief is going to come and go. And these reminders, these dates that come up, will always be something that will trigger their memories and will cause them to feel some distress. But that's normal. And I think one of the most important things in talking to people, even this far out, a lot of people that we see and still see, they think they're not normal because they haven't gone on this line of getting better. And so I think one of the most important things we can do is remind people that these kind of reminders are going to be there. They're going to create some distress, and that's okay because that distress is not going to last forever at that level.
Deborah, can you speak to what people can do if they are expecting to be triggered by something difficult like a 10-year remembrance?
One of the things that we tell people they can do is if they think that something like this event coming up is going to cause them to feel a lot of emotional distress, stay away from it. Yeah, there's nothing that says you have to go to a memorial or you have to go down to what will be the new memorial or that you have to watch the news about it. In some ways, taking care of yourself means doing what helps you feel better. And if that day is spending the day alone, spending it with some friends, doing something that makes you feel good or feel loved, that's more important than showing up at a memorial or watching the news about something that was one of the worst days of your lives. So again, I think giving people permission to do what is best for them rather than following a timeline or going to an event because they think they should be there. It's not about what you should do. It's about taking the very best care of yourself on a very difficult day.
What are some signs someone might be looking for, need to pay attention to, that they may need to involve professional help coping with whatever emotions they're feeling this week?
I think that if they find themselves feeling sadder, for example, than usual, or suddenly they find themselves crying and they're thinking, I'm not sure why I'm crying. This isn't something I should be crying about. I think being more angry and irritable, you know, shouting at your children, you know, getting angry at a friend because of X, Y, or Z. I think certainly feelings of hurting oneself or thinking about whether or not to die by suicide are other things that should let people know that they may need to reach out and for help, either from a therapist, from a clergyman, from a trusted friend, a family physician, anyone who will be there and will be able to help. It's really what we're talking about is an exacerbation, a change in the way that one typically goes about doing things. And now emotions are such that they find they're not coping and they're not functioning as well as they should be.
Deborah Beidle is Executive Director of UCF Restores and a Professor of Psychology and Medical Education at the University of Central Florida. If you feel like you need support, you can call, text, or chat the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. We ask you to share your thoughts or reflections, and Deborah sent us an email that says the quote, "Pulse structure should include music for dancing, which was in the hearts of all those we loved and lost. We want to keep dancing to honor them," end quote. Thank you, Deborah. We always want to hear from you. Send an email to engage@cfpublic.org and help us shape the conversation. There's more ahead here on Engage. Florida's legislative session is over, but state lawmakers are heading back to Tallahassee soon. We'll break down what passed, what's next, and how it impacts Central Floridians. Subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you never miss an episode.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Florida's 2026 legislative session is over, but the work isn't done. State lawmakers are expected to return to Tallahassee to sort out spending. Before the regular session adjourned last week, several significant bills passed. We're joined now by Douglas Soule, the state government reporter for WUSF, your Florida team, and Megan Bowman, their community engagement reporter. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks so much for having us.
Nice to be on.
Douglas, let me start with you. Big picture. The session ended without lawmakers completing their one required job, which is passing a budget. What does that tell you about this session?
You identified it yourself. The only required job for Florida lawmakers in the state constitution is passing the budget. That being said, it doesn't necessarily specify that it has to be done within the 60-day legislative session, but typically that is, in fact, what happens. And now we have a situation where for the second year in a row, we reach day 60 with no budget. So firstly, it shows less of an ability between the chamber leaderships to come to a deal. And additionally, I think the most important takeaway here is I'm not done seeing lawmakers in the Capitol this spring. I might even see them this summer. We don't know. But they're planning on coming back to the Capitol in mid-April for a special session focused on the budget. And that's interesting because in late April, they're already planning on coming to Tallahassee to talk about potential redistricting in a special session.
The budget has to be done by...
If the budget is not done by July 1st, the state would enter into a partial government shutdown. That would have pretty big effects. And it's kind of hard to know exactly how serious the effects would be because the state has never run into that. Now, I will say this, as I previously mentioned, the state lawmakers did not get a budget done on time, at least by the end of session last year as well. They still have to figure out what they're going to do with our appropriations going into next fiscal year. Now, the 2025 legislative session, because it was an off election, it wasn't an election year, started 2 months later than this one did. So there's a little bit less wiggle room last year to get the budget done. We have a 2 extra months to figure it out this time around. I think we're all hoping they don't need that 2 extra months to figure it out. I would love to know when I can safely schedule vacation, as would any lawmaker there. But they have a time to work with. And Senate President Ben Albritton, when he was kind of pushed on this lack of budget, he defended the process by saying, hey, we have time now that the policy stuff's out of the way, or at least most of the policy stuff is out of the way, we can now focus on this budget package.
Megan, you've been talking to Floridians about this. What are you hearing?
You know, similar to what Douglas said, overall, there is this sense of frustration at not finishing the one job they're required to do again, right? I don't think people were expecting as much infighting and drama this year. I spoke with Karen Smoke in Arcadia, who seemed to agree with that sentiment.
They just seemed to be dysfunctional. And it just was like it was all talk and no action, like the budget.
I also got to speak with Monica White from Tampa. She actually gave lawmakers the grade of a C or a D for this session. You know, she was frustrated that they didn't finish again and even added it shouldn't be a surprise for lawmakers to know they have to finish the budget since it's something that's written into the Constitution.
It just seems to me that I'm sure, you know, many others, like, they could have gotten this organized a little better so they would have had something in place, you know, by now or not have to go, you know, prolong it too much.
I also talked to a political professor at UCF recently, Aubrey Jewett, and he also brought up that it galls people when the folks we elect to do this job don't do it.
Even without a budget, lawmakers passed a number of significant bills. Let's highlight some of the big ones. There are new restrictions on DEI programs and a new process to designate certain groups as domestic terrorist organization. Douglas, tell us about what stands out to you with these bills.
The DEI law got a lot of debate in the Florida legislature. I mean, when this bill hit the floors of the respective chambers, they went hours and hours on the back and forth between Republicans and Democrats on this, with Democrats coming out hugely against the DEI law. So what it does, more specifically, is it prohibits Florida local governments, cities and counties, from funding, carrying out, or even promoting DEI initiatives. Now, this comes after recent years of lawmakers doing DEI restrictions. They've restricted it at the state government level. They've restricted it in other places as well, such as, you know, higher education. But this is the first time that they've passed a law specifically telling local governments what they can and can't do related to these programs. Republicans said taxpayers shouldn't have to fund such initiatives, while Democrats say the law is overly broad, and they also accuse it of being potentially unconstitutional. And they also worry that it could have economic impacts by limiting tourism and business profits tied to various diversity events. So that was one of the big conversation pieces of the session. There were, of course, others as well. The lawmakers, predominantly Republicans, pushed a bill that they said was related to public safety, which would allow the state to designate some groups as domestic terrorist organizations. They said that that would help protect the state, its interest, and its people. But there were some that worried, and especially some within the Democratic Party that worried, that this would be used to target groups the state disagrees with. They also worry it could be used to target Muslim-led organizations. That did pass, and now what we wait and see with both the DEI bill and the domestic terrorism bill, whether there might be a legal challenge, and if there is, who knows how that's going to go. But certainly not done covering these two bills, because I'll be covering that side of things as well as just the impact side of things. And I'm sure others will be looking at these going forward as well.
Megan, what are you hearing from people related to these issues?
So a majority of the people that I got to speak with are really concerned about the lasting impacts that these bills will have, like tourism and how it'll affect communities. So if we take the bill to designate groups as domestic terrorist organizations, Monica White in Tampa raised a really good point. She says bills like these create more hostility, and she questioned, you know, what impacts they'll have on the communities, especially if people are scared to donate maybe to a certain organization for fear of retribution. And then I also spoke with Sandra Johnson, who lives in Bradenton. She's retired now, but she spent many years working in human resources, and she is not a huge fan of the DEI bill.
I believe in diversity and inclusion. I believe that anytime you exclude human beings, you're being divisive and critical into what someone else's thinking is. And I think government needs to stay out of that.
I also got to speak to Kathy Gilfie in Pinellas County. She says that these types of bills marginalize communities, and she really highlighted the importance of communities actually coming together.
Minneapolis came up with a phrase, a word that really is something that resonated with me, and that was their neighboring. They go out and they neighbor, and that whole idea of they are now thinking in terms of we and not me. They realize the importance of their community. They realize the importance of the people in their community and how much everybody contributes to that.
Douglas, before we move on, could you speak to the consequences if local governments or politicians violate the bills that we're talking about right now?
Great question, and an important one, because if local officials do violate this measure, they could be removed from office, and local governments could additionally face litigation from residents. So this is a big deal for local governments, and it's definitely going to change how they operate moving forward. I don't think many local officials want to get kicked out of their positions. I don't think local governments want to get sued.
We're speaking with Douglas Soul, state government reporter for WUSF, Your Florida Team, and Megan Bowman, their community engagement reporter. Let's move to another area getting a lot of attention, that is data centers, these large server facilities. Douglas, can you talk to me about what's driving this push? It's not part of the governor's proposed artificial intelligence bill of rights. So what does this do?
Yeah, so let's first touch on the AI bill of rights. AI is top of mind. You turn on the radio, there's probably a 50-50 chance they're talking about AI effects in policy, or I guess the lack of policy currently, because we're not really seeing much at a federal or statewide level. Governor Ron DeSantis did want to see something at a statewide level regulating AI, but the House, led by House Speaker Daniel Perez, was a no-go on that. Notably, Perez and Governor Ron DeSantis have been feuding through session and through last session, so there wasn't maybe very much goodwill on either party to help one another out in terms of a policy preference standpoint. But the AI bill failed because of that, and Perez, he said it failed not related to the tensions between the governor, but he just pointed out how President Donald Trump has made clear that he wants to regulate AI at the federal level, and that issue kind of pins DeSantis against Trump in some ways. Obviously, that doesn't pin him against Trump now, because the legislature simply hasn't passed AI regulations, and DeSantis' term is getting shorter and shorter for them to do anything. And obviously, this was technically his last legislative session. That being said, they might have not touched that AI bill of rights. They did pass a bill involving data centers. For listeners who don't know, those are big buildings with a lot of computers. They store and process data, which is used for internet and AI services, for example. I had a buddy of mine who works in the industry explain all this to me over the weekend, actually, because it's pretty complicated how this all works. What's not complicated is the effects people see. And in some cases, there's concerns those data centers will increase utility costs on residents because of the sheer bulk of resources they require to operate. Now, the Florida legislature passed a bill which is aimed at making sure residents don't pay more for utilities because of these centers, which are already in Florida. And I think we could all expect to see even more in Florida. So that was a big deal from the AI data center standpoint. So there was some controversy toward the end of the process because lawmakers also dropped a part of the bill that would have restricted non-disclosure agreements between governmental entities and data center companies. There were some concerns about the effects of that on, I suppose, data center companies. And I'll tell you this, when I was in the Capitol, I even saw a lobbyist for data centers walking around with some degrees of attention toward this, because it's a high profile issue and it's an issue that's not going away. We're going to see this talked about, no doubt, in some capacity next session and probably for my whole lifetime of sessions. And this is a first step at addressing these data centers in the state of Florida.
Megan, are you hearing those concerns being raised by residents?
Yes. You know, like a lot of what Douglas said, some of the folks I spoke to, there is a little bit of confusion on what it means if these data centers come to their communities. So they really want as much transparency as possible, especially with that late drop of the provision that Douglas mentioned that would have restricted those NDAs between governments and the data center companies. Now, this bill, it did specify local control over land development with respect to data centers. And I spoke to Kim Heise, a watercolor artist and environmentalist living in Broward County. She actually says the data bill could have been better, but says it is nice that it got passed. But I just think really, you know, that confusion around what does it mean? And some of the folks that I talked to said, hey, I don't want that data center in my backyard even. So it's also not just about the buildings coming. It's about the environmental impacts and what that's going to do and how those communities will change and look as well.
Coming up, we'll continue our wrap-up of the 2026 Florida Legislative Regular Session by looking at what fell through the cracks and whether lawmakers are really focusing on what Floridians care about most. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Florida's legislative session wrapped up without a budget and with some major questions unanswered. We continue our conversation now with Douglas Soule, the state government reporter for WUSF, Your Florida Team, and Megan Bowman, their community engagement reporter. One of the biggest issues for voters in Florida is affordability, housing affordability, insurance affordability, just everyday costs. Did lawmakers pass anything that directly addresses those concerns?
There was some legislation that was focused on this affordability topic, a topic which, as we all know, is top of mind for Floridians and I suppose people nationwide. For example, there was a tweak to the Live Local Act, which is a significant law aimed at increasing affordable housing across this state. And there's some other things as well, but I think the overall frustration I picked up on in the Florida Capitol, that especially coming from the Democrats in the Capitol, is that they didn't do enough. Lawmakers on the Democratic side, they had a whole affordability agenda coming into session. They would address high insurance rates, high rental unit rates, etc. And none of what they wanted to pass passed. They say that there's a dysfunction between the Republicans and the legislature, which limited and kneecapped their ability to pass important legislative fixes to address the affordability issues in the state. So that's one of the issues that critics are saying was not sufficiently addressed in the House and Senate this year.
Megan, affordability, is that something that you are hearing about?
Look, nearly everybody I spoke to wanted to see lawmakers address the rising costs of things in the state: insurance, property taxes, gas, electricity. You know, here's Karen Smoke. We heard from her earlier from Arcadia.
Affordability is what's on everyone's mind.
I also talked to Cindy Tippy in St. Petersburg. She works in prison reform and land development.
I don't have rich people problems. I'm the bitch that gets up every day and goes to work whether I want to or not, whether I'm sick or whether I'm not. And my Florida Power and Light bill keeps going up, but yet I keep seeing them donate big PAC money.
I also got to speak with Sandra Johnson in Bradenton. She says she didn't see lawmakers address things that are impacting her daily life.
I don't see them doing anything about this. rising taxes, rising association dues for condominiums, rising insurance cost. So no, I don't see that my day-to-day life is any better because of my government.
And Kathy and Pinellas, who we also heard from a while ago, volunteers with Good Neighbors in Clearwater, helping get goods to food pantries.
The biggest, when you speak with folks, you know, whether it's friends or where you're volunteering and such, affordability is what you hear again and again and again.
Let's talk a little bit about what did not get passed. For a legislator with a Republican supermajority, some conservative priorities on the table didn't make it, from lowering the rifle buying age to 18 and expanding E-Verify. Douglas, any thoughts on why that is?
That's always an interesting question, especially since, you know, the bills you just identified have progressed on the House side in the past in previous sessions. It's an example of, well, yes, I mean, the Florida legislature is incredibly conservative, supermajority Republican, but they don't always see eye to eye on every issue. Let's talk the gun buying age. Following the Parkland shooting, lawmakers were understandably horrified and passed a number of different laws addressing gun safety. One of them was raising the long gun buying age, the age to buy shotguns and rifles, from 18 to 21. Now, as the years have passed, more Republicans in the legislature, particularly on the House side, are coming out against that. They're saying it's against what they believe in terms of the Second Amendment. And Governor Ron DeSantis also is encouraging lawmakers to reduce that back down to 18. But the Senate has been resistant to that. Similarly, with E-Verify expansions, it passed the House. The Senate didn't pick it up. I do believe that there's some concern about labor shortages related to that bill. But we didn't even hear much discussion about it on the Senate side because they didn't consider it, didn't make it close to the Senate floor. So that's one of those situations where there was a lack of seeing eye to eye between the chambers, and we'll have to see if that continues going into these special sessions.
Megan, are you hearing people respond to the bills that didn't pass as much as they are to the ones that did?
Oh, yeah. A lot of people obviously have certain things that are important to them. We're all different, right? Kim Heise in Broward County, she's been volunteering with conservation groups for a while, but just got involved in the political side of things this year.
There's been an unbiblical amount of anti-environmental bills that were filed this session, more than usual, although it's not unusual for there to be bad environmental bills in Florida.
So, Kim, she was thrilled that the legislature did not pass the Blue Ribbon Project bill. That would have created a fast-track approval process for developments larger than 10,000 acres.
We had to, like, call them and put out calls to action, and they got hundreds of calls and emails about this bill. And it stinks that we have to work this hard for our legislature to do what they're supposed to do when they're the ones that we've hired to do that. And they're supposed to know what they're doing.
So Heise wants to see lawmakers also fund Florida Forever. And she says lawmakers really should not be surprised to see Floridians speaking out against overdevelopment, especially considering the public pushback against building hotels and golf courses in state parks that we saw last year. I also got to speak with Karen Smoke. We heard from her before. She's from Arcadia. She was disappointed in overall in how the session went.
Legislature could be either reactive and try to fix problems after they arise, or they can be proactive and spot potential problems and then create solutions.
Karen said the only real solution, though, is to make everyone feel like they're a part of the community and society and that they have opportunities to advance just like everybody else.
So session is over, sort of, for now. As we move forward into these special sessions, Douglas, what are you going to be watching for?
So first, to recap, we currently have plans for a mid-April budget-focused special session. In addition, we have the governor already having set a late April special session focused on potential redistricting. Lawmakers also say they're going to want to figure out a proposal for the 2026 ballot that would reduce property tax via a special session. We don't know exactly when that would be, but certainly, we're looking at a busy agenda this spring, this potentially summer, related to these legislative issues. And the big question is can they come to a consensus between the chambers on the budget, on redistricting, and on the property tax? The House already passed a proposal addressing property tax reduction, but the Senate seemed to think it went too far. And it's already looking like there could be a feud between the chambers on that issue, but we don't know. We don't know how much goodwill is remaining between leadership on both sides. It's going to have consequential effects on Floridians down the line, though. So keep on watching, keep on listening, keep on reading, because we've got a busy few months in with hugely important impact.
Douglas Soule is a state government reporter for WUSF, your Florida team, and Megan Bowman is their community engagement reporter. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Glad to be on.
Now that lawmakers are going to have a special session to figure out the budget, property taxes, and more, what do you feel got overlooked? Which issues do you want us to keep following? Send an email to engage@cfpublic.org or send a talkback on the Central Florida Public Media app and let us know. That's all for this week's edition of Engage. All of our shows are available on demand at cfpublic.org or wherever you get your podcast. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. NPR News is next.